Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, in episode 248, we return with the Traditional Journal Club. I'm joined by Drs. Farina Ali and Dr. Daniel Chow for discussion of some of the recent publications in major ophthalmology journals. Before I tell you a little bit more about these articles, just remember that the Vit Buccal Society episode 3 of the online series will be next week, July 29th at 8:30 p.m. Remember that this is a free event. It's a free Zoom webinar. You can log in and subscribe on our link in the episode description. I'll take you to the website to get information on that. And look forward to seeing everyone there with some great debates, some great quick-hitting sessions, as well as Dr. Carl Rodillo giving a great update on treatments for dry macular degeneration. So look forward to seeing all of you there. In terms of the journal club, again, we cover some of the major publications in recent ophthalmology journals. This includes a discussion of a study looking at caffeine and beta blocker use for ophthalmology fellows during simulated vitreoretinal microsurgery, as well as a cost savings article by Dr. Ravi Parikh and company about intravitreal antivascular endothelial growth factor cost savings associated with increasing reimbursement for bevacizumab in the United States. And we end with a couple of articles, one about a report from the American Academy of Ophthalmology looking at secondary IOLs in the absence of zonular support, and an editorial by Dr. Philip Rosenfeld and Dave Browning about brolucizumab. Remember that you can claim CME for this episode and many other podcast episodes by going to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. You can get there by clicking on the link in the episode description. And I'll find a list of financial disclosures for all contributors to this episode is listed in the episode description as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two of our colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Farina Ali from Dallas, Texas. Farina, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Jay.
And last but not least, Dr. Daniel Chow from San Diego, California. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Jay.
So this is a traditional podcast journal club. We can say traditional because we've been doing this for enough years that we can call it traditional. And so what we are going to do is go through some recent publications in major ophthalmology journals, ranging from full-length kind of prospective studies all the way to editorials. So the first paper is from JAMA Ophthalmology. Its title is Association of Weight-Adjusted Caffeine and Beta Blocker Use with Ophthalmology Fellow Performance During Simulated Vitreoretinal Microsurgery. Roizenblatt was the senior author with Mauricio Maya was the senior author, Roizenblatt as the first author. Dan, do you just want to briefly summarize what they set out to do in the study and what the results showed?
Yeah, so this was a prospective study of 15 vitreoretinal surgery fellows from Brazil. Sounds like that had just started, so not much surgical experience. And then what they wanted to do was then assess the effect of weight-adjusted caffeine as well as the use of beta blockers, in particular propranolol. So they did this by having the surgeons do a battery of tests using the iSCIE vitreoretinal surgical simulator. This included things like there was an anti-tremor test, maneuvering of in the eye, as well as various tasks. There were four tasks in particular. They did this over 2 days, and they tried a bunch of different conditions. And the surgeons were masked, so each of the pills looked very similar. So it was a single bath study, and there was a sequence where they started with the placebo and then 2.5 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram and then a higher dose of caffeine. And then at the very end, they gave propranolol, and they repeated these tasks. So they had 1 day like that. They had another day where they started with the propranolol and then added the caffeine. And what they found was that with either the low dose or high dose caffeine, that the scores were worse than the placebo in all of the tasks measured, and that the addition of propranolol after administration of caffeine could mitigate some of these effects, but not to the level of just propranolol use alone. So it looked like propranolol use by itself had the best tests than placebo, and then these varying forms of caffeine.
Farina, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty and limitations. Like I said, we're going to do nitty-gritty in a second, but let's ask the important question listeners want to know, Farina. Do you have coffee on surgery days?
I do have coffee on surgery days. I mean, I think one thing that they looked at here was like the mean average use of their 15 surgeons, and it was like one, like a little over one cup. And if they had two or more cups, they were excluded from the study. So I am within that range, probably less than a cup, enough to kind of keep me busy in the pre-op kind of area, just have a little bit of something and then kind of go in to do the case. I have not so much, you know, been kind of worried about that. I will say that when I was at Wills, as a fellow like you, Jay, you operate every day. And so when you're doing something like that every day, I feel like that kind of mitigates a drastic change that might occur. Let's say you have one OR day a week, or not drastic, but kind of a more differential effect. And so I sort of, you know, feel okay about it. To answer your question.
Some limitations of this study, just to summarize, they did use a simulator. This was only with novice surgeons. It's something we can talk about in a second. This is a pretty small sample size overall. But it's interesting, and that's why I think JAMA Ophthalmology published it. Your point is accurate. I think, Dan, how about the point about novice surgeons, right? So my thought is, when you're starting, whether it's psychological or physical or the muscle memory is not there, I think controlling all the variables, maybe it's just us feeling better, but it feels like maybe some things matter. Farina referenced caffeine intake, but I used to think about, you know, am I exercising? Am I, lifting weights the day before surgery? Do these things matter? I don't know. These are the things I wonder about.
Yeah, Jay, I do think for novice surgeons, certainly I think there's a bit more variability in terms of their comfort with vitreoretinal surgery coming in. There are more things to think about, which I think would result in more effects on these battery of tests. So I do feel that if you really wanted to assess the contribution of caffeine and beta blockers, as they mentioned in the text, to do it on experienced surgeons, would be very interesting.
So what about using a beta blocker for trainees? This is something I feel like no one really did it when we were residents together, Dan, but people have talked about this in training. Farina, I don't know if anyone in your residency used it. You know, one of the things that was brought up as well, do you really want the crutch and then you have to train yourself off of it? But we use other crutches when we're training. I feel like at least when we were residents, we would start at the VA with blocked patients rather than topical. Some programs do that, some programs don't. You always obviously have the crutch of having an attending watching your every move and kind of making sure. So do you think that, Dan, I'll let you go first, and then Farina, just because you training fellows right now, do you think this is something you'd be like, well, you know, maybe it's not a bad idea for my fellow to take a little beta blocker? Or would you worry about kind of the either true dependence on it or almost like the Dumbo magic feather concept where psychologically then they feel like they need it to succeed?
I think it's very reasonable, especially starting out, if there is a tremor that I feel is inhibiting their ability to learn or perform the surgery. I think certainly offering to use a beta blocker and seeing how that would work and its effect on the tremor is very appropriate. I would say for them to try it prior on a non-surgical day to make sure that there weren't any adverse events. But I think certainly to trial, see whether it helps, certainly can be helpful. I think I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of aids that we use, maybe specific microscopes or what have you. And I think this is just another one of those things. And if it will help improve surgical technique and the safety of the surgery, I don't think it's a bad idea. And I think also with time, that also may change. One other tip that actually one of my colleagues, Bill Freeman, had mentioned is that sometimes he's suggested to use actually topical eye drops like topical timolol or Kosop and to put it under the tongue, almost like a sublingual administration, and let it sit there for a little bit. And that may also be something which may have less systemic effects, but also something potentially to try.
Farina, was there frequent beta blocker usage in your residency program? Are you going to be the Jose Canseco and reveal all the dark secrets of the UCSF residency?
No, we didn't use it. There was an attendant who you know, I trained somewhere else, I don't remember, but also mentioned the sublingual timolol. It wasn't something that was mentioned very much at all. But I would agree with Dan. I feel like, I don't know that I would be a proponent of blanket use, but if there is a surgeon that finds that they have, you know, a tremor, particularly with peels or something like that, or has already known that to be true based on their experience in cataract surgery, I think it's worth thinking about and worth trying. But outside of that, I think, you know, as a trainee, when you're starting your first surgeries as a resident, when you're starting your first surgeries as a fellow, there's so much to think about and so much to keep track of that I'm not necessarily a proponent of adding something like a pharmacologic agent to the mix, unless there's like a known need or potential benefit, in my opinion.
I mean, if you use prednisolone drops with your sublingual timolol, it'd be like the cream in the clear all over again. So, you know, from conversations of pharmacologic age, we're going to transfer to this next article from Ophthalmology, which is intravitreal antivascular endothelial growth factor cost savings achievable with increased bevacizumab reimbursement utilization. This is by Glasser et al. Robbie Parikh, a friend of the podcast, has been on before, was on this article as well. Freena, do you want to summarize what they did and what they showed in this study?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting article by this group that often will look at questions like this, which are cost analyses around the utilization of the different anti-VEGF agents and kind of the implications of that. So this is another example of that. And again, this is a mathematical model using Medicare Part B as well as IRIS registry data to look at patient savings associated with increasing the utilization of bevacizumab, which obviously we know is cheaper compared to on-label use of aflibercept and ranibizumab. And so specifically what they're looking at is if there is an increased utilization or increased market share of bevacizumab, and in addition to that, an increased reimbursement, can we see cost savings as a whole? And so the modeling that they do is very interesting. And I think one thing that I will mention, it is really worth, especially for those folks that are end of fellowship or early on in practice, they do a really nice summary here in the payments and costs section, looking at how the margin is determined and how much the physician takes home and how that relates to the cost of the drug. And all of that is kind of very well laid out. And what they found is that there were an increase in bevacizumab reimbursement to $125.78 from a number that, you know, is listed in the paper, that equalizes the margin that you would get with aflibercept otherwise. And so the motivation behind this being is the decreased reimbursement for using bevacizumab, a disincentive for using the drug. And if we could obviate that, do we see cost savings as a whole in a field where intravitreal injections are the highest, you know, highest volume procedure and, you know, a fair cost to the system. And so what they found looking at that number as sort of a kind of break-even point, but also looking at some other modeling with different percentages of increasing market share, is that in total, there could be a potential savings of $468 million for Medicare Part B savings, and then patient savings in terms of their copay of almost $120 million. And this would be reflective of a bevacizumab increased market share of 10%, you know, compared to what they found it to be based on the IRIS registry data. And so, I mean, I think there are a bunch of interesting points here. One thing that historically, you know, had been kind of a mainstay is that bevacizumab utilization in general has been thought to be pretty stable. But in fact, this paper at least revealed to me that over time, that aflibercept utilization has increased such that at least based on IRIS registry data, I think it was listed at about 43% for the aflibercept and 36% for Avastin, which historically Avastin had been the highest utilized. So that is a trend that is changing over time, which obviously has cost implications. The other thing that I think is particularly relevant and worth thinking and knowing about, which I didn't as a trainee, is that the the payment reimbursement is determined regionally by different contracted organizations through Medicare. And so a lot of these costing models have to account for those regional differences. And so that is valuable, but also kind of speaks to the, you know, heterogeneity in kind of our whole kind of healthcare system that can make things complicated. And then the added layer of that being that Avastin is, you know, not an on-label. It's not a drug that you can just purchase the way you could aflibercept and ranibizumab, in that it needs to come from a compounding pharmacy and there's variability there. And so that lends to different calculations as well. But I think, you know, ultimately the paper kind of tells us what we might expect, which is that if we increase utilization of a lower cost drug, but incentivize the use of that by physicians being able to take home more money in terms of being able to maintain their supply and procure the drug and all of that stuff, will there be cost savings on a whole? And the answer is that, you know, based on their modeling, there would be. So it's a very interesting question and a nice way to answer it.
That was a terrific summary, Farina. And Dan, I'm going to get your thoughts. I think this is just a wonderful way. It's very rare in medicine or any field that you show by increasing the price of something, you can actually induce cost savings. But that's exactly what is true with bevacizumab. Although, as Farina mentioned, there are some other reasons people may not use bevacizumab besides the reimbursement. Dan, your thoughts on this analysis? And hopefully this will reach some ears in terms of managing insurance payouts.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was a fantastic paper. And it also, you know, this could actually be one of the most impactful papers when we think about U.S. government policy, because just this suggestion, and if you look at the numbers, I think these are all very reasonable numbers. I mean, you're looking at $500 million dollars in savings and over $200 million in savings for patients. And so I really like this paper. I thought, again, it was fascinating to really understand the margins, and I thought it was very well done. And I hope that these insurance companies take this to heart, because I think this will be great for the whole healthcare system.
You know, the other thing to factor in here is I just like the idea, again, I feel a lot of times when procedures are presented or expenses are presented, then the result is the cutting of a code or something like that. But it'd be interesting to apply this kind of philosophy to preventative services, even in ophthalmology, and saying, hey, rather than cut this expensive CPT code, maybe we should increase the payment for a less expensive code that could be utilized as preventative therapy. And we don't necessarily see that often. So maybe this also sets a precedent for that sort of analysis, where you can look and say, hey, if you do like X amount of well visits a year, this is what it adds up to in terms of savings, in terms of preventing some sort of surgery or some sort of procedure down the line that's much more expensive. So I like the precedent they're setting too, not just for intravitreal injections, but for policy and kind of looking at healthcare in whole. Because I think sometimes the people making these policies just don't have insight. And so they think that the best way to create savings is just to cut codes. And that necessarily doesn't work. It hasn't borne out that way. We still have, despite all the cuts to the codes, we still have increasing healthcare costs. So it really is about more smartly reimbursing codes. And sometimes if you can reimburse certain codes that are done by people who perform preventative services, or in this case, a less expensive alternative, then you can reap the benefits as a country. But Farina, any final thoughts on this article?
Yeah, I think to your point, one sort of relevant thing as well is that looking at that sort of same idea in terms of reimbursement for telemedicine screenings, we know time the cost savings are enormous. So again, it's not just like, you know, a simple kind of numbers game. There, it's much more complicated than that in thinking about how things can be reimbursed. So it's interesting. And I think we're going to obviously be paying a lot more attention to that as healthcare utilization increases. So very timely.
The next article, I'm going to ask Dan Chavez questions first, because he's got to leave us for another meeting, because he is a busy, busy, busy man. We have intraocular lens implantation and the absence of zonular support, an outcomes and safety update. This is a report by the American Academy of Ophthalmology by Shen et al. I'll quickly summarize. So this is, we were talking about this before we started recording. This is, depending on how you look at this, this is either a very complicated study or a very simple study. There was definitely a lot of work involved. They went back through all the peer-reviewed literature, PubMed and Cochrane Library through July 2019. looked at 734 citations and chose 45 abstracts that were relevant to the assessment of these objectives, looking at secondary IOLs in the absence of IRIS support. And they graded the level of evidence and looked, and they look at the different studies available for anterior chamber lenses, iris claw lenses, sutured lenses to the iris, sutured lenses to the sclera, and then different gauges of suture, 10-0 and 8-0 proline suture, Gore-Tex sutured, as well as just scleral fixation with the haptics. And they review all of this. There's some trends that are interesting. You see more CME, for example, in iris sutured and scleral sutured lenses than with ACI wells, but you're less likely to get uveitis with the non-anterior chamber technique. You can get more glaucoma, for example, in some of the scleral sutured, proline sutured groups. But, the take-home points are things we've talked about before. There's no clear superiority, if you look at all these studies, one technique over the other, and each technique kind of has its own risks and benefits. And I think there's limitations to this. It's a great analysis. It's important to kind of review this literature. Some important limitations. First of all these studies are conducted on different patient populations. So the risks we're talking about are percentages and sometimes single percentages. It's hard to compare. They have a nice table kind of summarizing this and going back and forth. But the other kind of thing I would say is Gore-Tex lenses, if you look at the tables, come out really well. It's like no zero risk of this, zero risk of that. Well, we just don't have as much literature on long-term follow-up. And I like Gore-Tex suture lenses. We just don't have that much long-term follow-up on them. So I wouldn't read too much into that. There's a lot more follow-up on proline suture lenses than Gore-Tex suture lenses. So we have to wait and see over the next 5, 10, 15 years if those numbers still say zero in all these tables. Dan, any quick thoughts before you go?
No, I thought that was a fantastic summary, Jay. The only thing I would have to add is that also these studies aren't really controlled for the skill and experience of the surgeon, in terms of we all know that there's a learning curve to using each of these different techniques, though likely the people who are publishing this are probably those that perform the highest volume. So that may control a little bit for that. And as they say, it would be great to have a randomized study, but I think that would really be quite impractical unless you're looking at very limited follow-up, say within 6 months and 1 year. So it will be interesting to see how we continue to compare the different types of IOL fixation techniques.
Dan, thanks for your time. Take care.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Dan.
Farina, now that Dan's gone, we can have some real fun. Hopefully Dan didn't stay on the line to hear what we say about him. So what are your thoughts? So based on the summary and this kind of look at the IOL techniques, anything to add on top of what Dan said?
No, I think it was a great summary. I think that there were a few things that I took away from this. One, the way the analysis was done was such that, like in terms of, as you were saying, the heterogeneity in the studies, where they were done and all this stuff, didn't allow for any, it wasn't powered enough to have any statistical comparisons made. So this is really a qualitative assessment in a sense, and I think that's worth knowing. And then a couple of other things that I was reminded of is that ACI wells are the only FDA approved lens for surgery in a patient without zonular support, and I think it's a good reminder for surgeons to know that just in general in terms of risk documentation, whatever it might be. I don't know that I knew that quite explicitly, so that's worth knowing. And then that CV8 on the label, so Gore-Tex suture, it is indicated there that it is contraindicated in ophthalmic surgery. As you mentioned, we have more recently started using that. We have some data, not a ton of data. I feel extremely comfortable using it, but I think it's worth knowing that that's on the label. And I think those were good reminders to me from this assessment by the Academy.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting to note, as you said, ACIOL is the only FDA approved so far for implantation in the setting of AFib with a zonular support. Technically, everything else we're doing is off-label, which is interesting, even though we may use those lenses and those sutures, not Gore-Tex, but proline in other contexts. So the last article I wanted to just discuss quickly, not to beat a dead horse, but I thought it was a really clever and really this intelligent article. It was an editorial in AJO. Is this a 737 max moment for brolucizumab? By Philip Rosenfeld and Dave Browning. And if you haven't read this, I would read it. Again, it's not a true article. I'm not going to summarize or go through every single thing that was mentioned here. But I thought the analogy was interesting in terms of kind of really quantifying what this risk is. and kind of comparing it to other industries in the sense of, you know, this may be like just like the 737 MAX is pulled off the market until this could be addressed, whether this has to happen. And this was published maybe about a month ago now, and it hasn't been pulled. And I don't think we're going to see it get pulled, and we're going to see how this evolves over time. But I feel like obviously there's so much else going on in the world, such as the pandemic and then the protests and the social issues that have come up. This is way tertiary to any of those, but within the field of retina, this is actually still a pretty relevant issue. It would be interesting to see what Novartis's kind of game plan is. You know, I haven't heard much for Rina. I don't have any inside information, but I just wonder how they approach this, right? So I've heard they've tried to see if this is a manufacturing issue versus a compound issue, but I do wonder if there's going to be strategies to help us predict which patients can get the idiopathic inflammation and vasculitis, which can cause these devastating visual complications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the idea that maybe it was a manufacturing compounding thing is has proven not to be true, as far as I know. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think that that has been borne out. And then, you know, I think they highlight here the very important risk, which is that the inflammation that occurs is unpredictable. So you can have a good response, and then you can have inflammation, and then you can have vasculitis at an unpredictable time frame or unpredictable number of injections. And that is, of course, concerning. It is interesting if we kind of, you know, in general, if as we move towards more agents to help us treat disease, if we can customize things in some ways. But I also think that we're at a point where we have drugs that are very efficacious that we know to work in a broad sense. So the amount of extra work that might be needed both on the provider, patient, you know, healthcare utilization standpoint for kind of parsing things out further in order to use a specific drug, I think is a bit of a hard sell, but very academically interesting. I think what I liked about this editorial is that, you know, we got, you know, a report from ASRS, the REST committee, and, you know, other sort of means by which to learn, you know, that there are adverse events that are occurring also from Novartis. But I think that sometimes it is helpful for someone to synthesize that and sort of make a statement or make a recommendation, especially for folks that haven't used the drug yet. Should they use it? And sort of, you know, kind of get a little guidance on that. And I think that their statement here is pretty unequivocal and very helpful in that they said, in the face of the known risk, the use is unwarranted. Again, this is the opinion of the authors, but, you know, staking a claim as opposed to here's what we see, you know, kind of decide on your own, which is not a bad thing, but I think that it can be helpful to have some driving forces in the field to make some recommendations, particularly in unique scenarios like this one. So I think it was a very valuable editorial in that sense.
That's really well said, because I think we sometimes overstate the value of taking a stand. Just because you take a stand doesn't mean that it's better, but we like it. We like when people take stands because they make it, you know,
yeah.
But in a way, I think a lot of the frustration I feel from the community has been organizations not taking stands, and maybe it wasn't fair for them all to take stands because they didn't have all the available information, and, you know, they're not there necessarily to make those recommendations. So I think that I just wonder, you know, they changed the label. That's one of the things we haven't really talked about. The FDA label has changed where it mentions this risk. It doesn't quantify, it doesn't put a percentage, but it says there are reports of it. On the one hand, the FDA label, you could say it's important that it's been recognized officially and it's formal, and that's actually legally potentially very important for providers to know to consent patients for it and then offers protection that this is a known risk of the drug. On the other side, again, I think people found it a little frustrating because the label change doesn't necessarily address how or when are we going to use this medication. So does changing the label actually change how often people may choose to use it? We all will have different opinions. My opinion, and I was asked about this recently, is it's not going to change whether or not I use it. I'm just not using it right now. But I don't know. I felt like that was one of those things that may have felt on paper more impactful than it was. But if it's not practically changing the usage of the drug or people's comfort with using it, then I don't know what it achieves beyond some legal protections. But again, I guess it's still better than nothing. I think it's still good that the FDA recognized this and changed it after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the risks of the label being too prescriptive limits the use of on-label use, right? So then you could be exposed to more risk, which is not good. And then I think, you know, the middle ground is kind of protecting yourself in sort of a broad way, which is, I think, what, you know, I'm no expert on this, but I think that was the approach in my mind.
Farina, we made it. We had so many technical difficulties. We had phantom phone calls.
We did.
We had to switch to your burner phone over your regular phone, your Breaking Bad phone. We had Dan Chow have to leave us early, which is never auspicious, but we made it. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time, and we'll catch up soon.
Take care, Jay. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. You'll find 248 episodes there, including this one. They're sorted by category and they're great to go back and listen to. You can also click on the link to subscribe to our mailing list. That will give you updates on episodes as they come out. I personally subscribe on my mobile device to the Apple Podcast app, or if you have an Android device, you use the Android Podcast app to find us in the App Store. Remember that we're on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can always contact us directly by emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. It's RETINAPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again to Drs. Daniel Chow and Farina Ali for joining me. Thank you to Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benacasa for putting together this episode. And thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire each week, and the patient care you deliver on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.